It's wonderful to see such a great crowd here. My name is Kent Fox. I serve as provost. Today is the start of International Education Week. It's an initiative that's jointly sponsored by the U.S. Department of State and the Department of Education. And each year, the Annaudy Center takes advantage of this week and has public events related to international education. I'm delighted that today, in conjunction with the Annaudy Center and its annual reception that we're going to participate in about 30 minutes, we have the opportunity to hear from Fred Lagerwal. Fred is Cornell's Vice Provost for International Affairs. Early in 2012, our President David Skorton called our attention, the attention of the community, to the vital significance of Cornell's international dimensions and engagement and expertise and scholarship. His white paper, which was entitled Bringing Cornell to the World and the World to Cornell, urged both immediate action as well as long-term strategic planning for the impact we wanted to achieve, and specifically the goal of strengthening both international studies and international engagement. Soon after that, a faculty task force, which was chaired by Alfonso Torres and included individuals like Fred, went to work to study those issues. Their report, which is now available on the Provost website, offered more than 24 specific recommendations to enhance and expand the university's already extensive international activities and to address areas where Cornell was underperforming in comparison to some of our peers. With the input of the president, with the input of Fred Lagerwal, Alice Pell, the deans of all our colleges, and the vice provost and others, we created actually a response to that report, which is now available also on the provost website, where we go through each of the 24 recommendations and give the university's leadership's response to it. We've adopted almost all of them. The report gave us a roadmap, and we are agreeing to follow it. And I'm glad to have my opportunity once again to thank the members of that task force, Alfonso, for his leadership of it, and all the members of that faculty group. To advance internationalization at Cornell, we're fortunate to have the leadership also of Fred Lagerwal. Fred is the Stephen and Madeline Ann Binger Professor of History and the director of the Annaudy Center for International Studies, in addition to being our Vice Provost for International Affairs. The Annaudy Center for decades has been the home of numerous programs in area studies, thematic studies, and development studies. It's the hub of international activity for the whole university. It supports, for example, the Bartels World Affairs Fellowship, the International Relations Minor, and other initiatives, as well as providing grants to faculty and grad students across the university. As I'm sure you all know, Fred is having quite a year. Just last month or so, after being appointed the next Vice Provost for International Affairs, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book on Vietnam, Embers of War. I happen to know personally that he came in this last night, or I guess it was this morning at midnight, from Paris, where he was given the prize from the American Library in Paris for his book. And I know that within hours, later this week, he's heading to Toronto, where he's a finalist. We don't know if he's a winner, but he's a finalist for the Kundal Prize in Historical Literature. Since becoming Vice Provost in July, Fred has been at work on a strategy for advancing Cornell's international dimensions, based on the task force report, based on the input of others and his own ideas. He's identified priority areas. He's distilled those from, as I said, the white paper. And he's also now developed his own call to action, which is available on his website, which he spoke to the trustees a few weeks ago and to Cornell's council members. And now it's my privilege to welcome Fred to the podium so you all can hear from him his own perspective on Cornell and how we can achieve even greater excellence in this area. Fred?
Well, thank you, Provost Fox. I want to thank you, Kent, for being here this afternoon, for introducing me. I want to thank you also for your support for what we're trying to do internationally and for the very tangible backing that you've given to the Annaudy Center, to the Vice Provost's office, and also for giving me an opportunity to be here today as Vice Provost for International Affairs. I also am very grateful to all of you for coming. And for celebrating with us, because this is, after all, it's really two things. It's a short talk that I'm about to give, but it's also our annual Einaudi Center celebration. I think it's, for me, maybe the favorite part, the favorite single thing, the thing more than anything else that I love to do is to be here for our annual reception. That will follow this this talk. But what I want to do is spend just a few minutes this afternoon on this thing we call Global Cornell. I want to talk not so much about the specifics of what we're doing. That will be a talk for another occasion. But instead, say a few words about why it matters. I will say here parenthetically that, as Kent mentioned, there is available. And if you can't find it, just email me. I'll send it to you. But I do have a call to action paper that has been published that does talk about the what, the specifics of what I believe we need to be doing in the coming year, the coming 2 years, the coming few years in this area. But it will not be my concern here. I would also, in terms of the what, draw your attention to the task force report that, again, the provost mentioned, because it too speaks in specific terms about the things that we need to be doing in the minds of the task force. I believe we have a very important task ahead for Cornell as an institution, if we're going to meet our objective as articulated in the 2010 University Strategic Plan, which is to be a top 10 research university in the world. That's at the very center of that strategic plan. So we have a crucial task in that regard. And we have a crucial task in terms of our students. For our students, if we're going to produce the leaders of tomorrow who will live and work in a globalized world. I want to say up front what we already know, but I think is important, especially for me as a historian, to point out, which is that Cornell has always been international in its orientation. Our first president, Andrew Dixon White, was a cosmopolitan man who had lived and studied abroad. And he took that experience that he had gained internationally into the presidential office here on campus. From the start, the university welcomed students and professors from outside the United States. And we could speak also of faculty members such as Goldwin Smith, early faculty members such as Goldwin Smith, who were committed internationalists. As early as 1925, Cornell sent professors to Nanking to help develop a plant breeding and improvement program for China. In the early years after World War II, the university was a leader in area studies, really pioneering institution as far as area studies programs go, and also in establishing, or I should say in building up, a robust and wide-ranging foreign language set of programs. In fact, that goes right back to the beginning of the university as well. I was quite interested to see that President White declared right at the beginning, when the university came into being, that Cornell would excel, not merely in ancient languages, but also in modern languages, in the teaching of modern languages. He thought, President White, that the instruction he had received at Yale in modern languages was, as he put it, and I love this, a broad farce, quote unquote. White said that the University of Michigan was a little bit better, but even Michigan, he said, only taught classes really at the elementary level. Cornell would be different. And he has a quote that I just want to read you. This is, again, Andrew Dixon White. He said, at Cornell, the experiment was first really tried of giving importance to these courses in modern languages and literatures, of making them equal in dignity with the courses in ancient languages, unquote. And he followed through on this by hiring faculty to teach these languages. The first languages, incidentally, were French, German, Italian, Spanish, Swedish, I'm happy to say, given my heritage. Danish, I'm not so happy to say, given my heritage. And soon thereafter followed Portuguese, Chinese, Persian, and interestingly enough, Icelandic. Then Arabic soon thereafter. So my point here is simply to say that from the start, the university had this international orientation. And today, if you look at the campus as a whole, we have individual faculty members who are world leaders in their field. We have departments that are on the cutting edge of international research. We have many faculty and graduate students who are connected in their research area to scholars all over the world. International students, meanwhile, the latest figures, I believe these are correct. International students make up more than 9% of the undergraduate student body. 25% of professional students are international. And a whopping 44.7% of graduate students are international. Our library collections are superb, not merely in national terms, but in international terms. In some cases, they are unsurpassed anywhere in the world. So we're doing a lot of great things, but we have more to do, as the provost suggested. I believe we need to do more if we are to be, as I want us to be, the exemplary international or transnational university. As an institution, we've lost ground. I don't think there's any question. And this, again, is something that David Skorton, that President Skorton, pointed out in his white paper that the provost mentioned. This has been, it's an interesting subject, why we've lost that ground. Part of it, I think, is flattering to Cornell in the sense that other universities saw what Cornell was doing, for example, in area studies, and said, we need to do the same thing. And so it's perhaps a mark of the importance of what we were doing that other universities have made those kinds of commitments. But it's a process that has lasted, I would say, for the last 25, 30 years. And we've seen at least some of the time, I dare say, a disconnect between rhetoric and action that I think has been unfortunate. And I think we are beginning now to rectify this. And I do think we need to reclaim the lost ground. And I think we can reclaim the lost ground. We indeed have comparative advantages that we should be utilizing, and I'll say something about those in a moment. But here's why this matters. And I want to focus really on two particular areas. It matters first for institutional reasons. Peer institutions, peer universities, have moved aggressively in recent years to strengthen their global presence, to internationalize their curriculum, to hire faculty who work in an international context and who can train graduate students to do the same. These universities have stepped up their efforts also to recruit the best international students, both at the undergraduate level, the professional level, and the graduate level. These universities know what we know in this room, that the world is miniaturizing. What happens in distant places is now often known almost immediately and unavoidably. The global flow of people and of ideas has accelerated, of knowledge has accelerated, and as a result, the economy, politics, and environment and cultural life of a particular nation, all those things are now impacted more than ever by events beyond the borders of that particular nation. And I think that the competition in global higher education is increasingly intense, and there's lots of evidence for this. It'll become more intense. About 2 weeks ago or so, I participated in something called the Beijing Forum, which is a high-profile event held every year in Beijing. The provost, I know, has been there before. I was a speaker on one of the panels. But what struck me about the Beijing Forum was how much the discussion there was, both on the panels, but also in the breakfast room, over lunch, in the hallways, how much discussion there was about world university rankings. I think I'm right in saying that about 10 years ago, nobody talked about world university rankings. I'm not sure we even had very many of those rankings, but they have become, I think it's fair to say, all the rage. And again, in Beijing, this was something that a lot of people were interested in talking about. Many of them said what we all say, which is that they are of dubious value, that the methodology is problematic to say the least, that they're arbitrary, but then they wanted to talk about the rankings. And I think they matter. Rightly or wrongly, those rankings will matter. I think they will matter more. And I would say that Cornell cannot be left behind. Our strategic objectives demand that we have a global presence, that we have a commitment to international studies, international engagement, to helping provide solutions to real-world problems. And if we reach, ladies and gentlemen, if we reach that top 10 status among world universities that the strategic plan calls for, commits us to, it will be because every aspect of Cornell's identity will derive, at least in part, from its status as a global university. I think it's going to be crucial to recruiting the best faculty in the years to come. And as you all know, we're engaged in a very important, in a major effort to do that, to hire and then, of course, to retain the best faculty. And I think this is going to be important. Our global presence will be important in that regard. And by extension, therefore, also in terms of recruiting the best graduate students, because they are going to follow, to a large extent, the faculty. So this is very important. But here's the thing. We're not starting from scratch. I talked already about our tradition of international engagement, going back to the university's founding. I think we have tremendous strengths all across the campus. I alluded to some of those. Strengths that, in terms of what we have in the humanities and social sciences, perhaps on the one hand, if I can put it in these terms, and in the sciences, the applied sciences, engineering, in the professional schools, on the other hand, on the other side. We have comparative advantages. What other institution could host an international conference, as Cornell did, and I want to say it was, I believe, September of 2011? An international conference on rice and language across Asia. Not only host that conference, because that's relatively easy to do. You bring people together from around the world and you have a conference. But what was distinctive about this conference, I think, was that many of the key participants were from right here on this campus. From CALS, from anthropology, from linguistics. That happened here at Cornell. I dare say it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for it to happen anywhere else. So this is the institutional argument. And by the way, it's not just about competition. Universities, I would say, are uniquely positioned to respond to the challenges of globalization as conduits of ideas, as laboratories for cutting-edge research, obviously, and also as kind of international cosmopolitan communities in miniature. Universities are really positioned, it seems to me, and will be positioned to respond to the challenges that we face in this smaller world. So that's the institutional argument in brief. But it's not the argument that I think is most important for us this afternoon. Crucial, though, I think it also is. I think we need to do this because it's the right thing to do for our students. What we prize at this great university, perhaps more than anything else, it seems to me, is the restless mind. That the mind that seeks out the beauties of nature, of scientific discovery, of people, of cultures that are different from one's own. We prize a mind that is open to explorations of what it means to be alive in today's world. And I think this is profoundly important. Every education, I submit to you, must include coming to terms with what it means to be different from oneself, to engage with other cultures, to appreciate other peoples, other nations, to appreciate nations, cultures that you might not agree with, but with whom you must have genuine engagement. There's a word for this that I want to come back to in my concluding remarks, and it's empathy. What I'm talking about here is global citizenship. And I think that preparing our students for that citizenship is what we have to do. I can't think of a more important task that this great university faces. What does this mean? What does global citizenship mean? I think it's a complex subject. We might disagree among ourselves in this room about the elements of that citizenship. I would say that it includes at least some of the following: geography, history, philosophy, economics, the interdisciplinary study of culture, the history of law and political structures, the study of religion, of agricultural systems, the acquiring of foreign language ability, and all of those things interacting with one another. It means, when possible, a period of study or service abroad, whether or not through a traditional semester program or year-long program or something else. For example, I think that we want to have more summer programs for our students. It can also mean internships with an overseas firm or an overseas agency of some kind. I think it can take many different forms, I guess is my point. And I think there's real momentum here because of the exciting new leadership that we have in Cornell abroad, because of the great work that is being done in engaged learning and research. And I see those two entities and others in the individual colleges, because there are these opportunities for overseas service and study within the colleges as well. I think that these entities can work together to great effect. And I think finally that what I'm talking about here in terms of global citizenship means interacting with international students and faculty right here in Ithaca. I said to David Skorton not too long ago that I agree with his call for having 50% of our undergraduates having a meaningful international experience while they're at Cornell. And we're going to work to meet that objective. But I said that perhaps we should shoot for 100%, which does not mean that 100% of our students go overseas. I think we can have an international experience right here in Ithaca, and we should endeavor to make that happen through the curriculum, obviously, through this interacting with international students and faculty. Having a roommate freshman year who is from another country could be, for example, a marvelous experience for our domestic students. But what we need to do, however we get there, what we need to do is produce graduates who have cross-cultural awareness, who have the international experience, in some cases at least the language capabilities, and more importantly, perhaps the cross-cultural communication skills necessary to succeed in the global economy. And here, too, there's a competitive dimension. You can perhaps sense this afternoon that I'm competitive by nature. So many of the jobs that our students will have after they leave Ithaca, whether in business or law or education or healthcare or engineering, so many of these jobs will be international in nature or in scope. Many of the students, mark my words, will be actually living and working overseas. And we need to get them ready for that world. That's really what it comes down to. To put it a different way, globalization is here to stay. And students who want to work in our increasingly interconnected world should have the need to have, must have, the tools to make it work for them. And I want to mention just here that we are going to have a workshop on February 10th that I'm very excited about. Hence, I want to just draw your attention to it here. We'll have more information on it. But a workshop at Cornell in which we consider the following question: what constitutes a meaningful international experience? Which I think is very important for us going forward. If we are going to meet President Skorton's objective of 50% of our students having such an experience, we need to decide what is acceptable under that definition and what isn't. By the way, parenthetically, I want to say that there's a national security argument here. As a historian of U.S. foreign relations, I feel obligated to point out that in terms of our national competitiveness going forward, and in terms of our, indeed, our national security going forward, this kind of cross-cultural awareness that I'm describing is important. If we're going to go to war against this or that country, it might not be a bad idea to know something about the country in question. And if we're going to have allies in said war, I think the same thing applies. More broadly, if the United States is going to compete in this new world, in this globalized economy, world economy of tomorrow, we need to have young men and women, young leaders who can move nimbly and with sensitivity in all four corners of the globe. So there's that argument as well, which I'm not really developing here today. I want to conclude with just a few words about empathy, the word that I mentioned earlier. If there's a single word that I'd like you to take away from today's talk, a single attribute that I'd like our students to have when they leave this place, it's that word. It's empathy. Empathy means understanding the thoughts and feelings of others. It's to be distinguished from sympathy, a word with which it's often confused, which I would define as feeling with others, as being in agreement with them. Empathy doesn't mean that. Empathy with opponents is therefore psychologically possible even when sympathy is out of the question. When the hostility between the two sides or between the two individuals is too strong to allow sympathy, you can have empathy. So I'm not talking here about agreeing with the other side, with the other group, only about realistic understanding. So the question is, how can empathy be achieved? Well, it means entering into another person's skin, imagining what it might be like to look at the world through her eyes, and imagining how you might feel about what you saw. It means being her, being that other person, at least for a little while, and postponing your reaction, perhaps your own hostility toward her, for a later time. Most of all, I think it means trying to look at one's own behavior honestly, as it might appear when seen through another person's eyes. Recognizing that, to be sure, her own views could be jaundiced, but recognizing at the same time that she has the advantage of not seeing, let's say, my own behavior, our behavior, through the rose-colored glasses that I might normally wear. She may have grounds for suspicion, for feeling mistrust and anger that I, in this case, might not have allowed myself to see. And that's where the honesty comes in. And I think it's because we realize that life presents challenges to even the most fortunate among us. It's because we realize that we're all flawed and vulnerable, that life is precious, must be treated with respect. It's because we realize all of those things that we're able to reach out empathetically to acknowledge the connections that we have with fellow human beings. I think you could say, as a wiser person than me has put it, that to empathize is to civilize. Michael Ignatieff, a Canadian scholar and politician, Michael Ignatieff has written perceptively about this in terms of world affairs. He has said this, that to act uninformed by empathy is to refuse to enter as fully as possible the mindset of an actual or potential adversary. It's to submit, Ignatieff says, to a kind of autism, the behavior of those who are so locked into their own myths that they can't listen, can't hear, can't learn from anybody outside themselves. In these instances, again according to Ignatieff, and I quote, what is denied is the possibility of empathy, that human understanding is capable of penetrating the bell jars of separate identities. But social peace anywhere depends, again, this is continuing with his quote, social peace anywhere depends for its survival on just this epistemological act of faith. When it comes to political understanding, difference is always minor, comprehension is always possible. So my point here, ladies and gentlemen, is that this is not merely about looking inward. Or I'm sorry, looking outward. It's not merely about looking at the world for its own sake, on learning about the world out there for its own sake. I would submit to you that to really understand American culture, American institutions, American traditions, we need to learn about others. As I like to say, if you only understand your own culture, you don't really understand your own culture. So, in a very real sense, I guess this is the point that I'm making. In a very real sense, if we can teach our students, undergraduate, professional, graduate, if we can teach our students to think empathetically, we have succeeded. It's not to suggest that empathy by itself is enough, that empathy is some sort of guarantee that we will have a peaceful world, a world in which we can live together and work through our problems, but I do think it is an essential prerequisite for such a world. And I think this is what Senator J. William Fulbright had in mind when he said many decades ago, I love this quote, and I want to read it to you. J. William Fulbright. He said, "International education is the most significant current project designed to continue the process of humanizing mankind to the point we would hope that people can learn to live in peace. We must try to expand the boundaries of human wisdom, empathy, and perception. And there is no way of doing that except through education." That's William Fulbright. And on that note, I'm going to close. Cornell University should be the exemplary international university in an increasingly interconnected world. And it's within our capacity to be that place. The university's unparalleled combination of breadth and quality, its long history of international engagement, again going right back to Andrew Dixon White, I often think about what it would have been like to be here with President White as this thing was starting out at this very place. And in those early classes, there were international students. You can go back and look, for example, in Carol Kamen's history to get a sense of where some of these students came from, faculty who came from overseas. But we have that long history of international engagement. We have the unparalleled breadth and quality. And we have a faculty that is international already and will become more so. So we can be that place, ladies and gentlemen, but we have work to do. I thank you.